Good afternoon and welcome to the June meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations, coming to you today from the Samoset in Rockport on the beautiful coast of Maine, and a particular welcome to our public radio audience. My name is Mac DeFord. I'm the president of the Forum. Since 1985, the Forum has been meeting monthly to hear an invited expert from the world, from the Foreign Service, from journalism or academia, talk about the critical foreign policy issues facing the United States and answer questions from our members and guests, many of whom are experts in their own right. Details about past and upcoming programs are available on our website at midcoastforum.org. The Midcoast Forum today is delighted to have James Farwell talk to you, an expert in strategic communication and information operations. He has advised the U.S. Special Operations Command, the U.S. Strategic Command, and the Department of Defense on counterterrorism and counterinsurgency in the Middle East, North Africa, and Pakistan. He's written articles for the International Institute for Strategic Studies, the Middle East Institute, Defense IQ, and the IO Journal. He is an attorney, a practicing attorney with degrees from Tulane and the University of Cambridge. He's also a political consultant who has worked nationally and internationally at the presidential level. His most recent book, The Pakistan Cauldron, is about what you're going to hear him talk about today. It came out last October, so it's very timely. James lives in New Orleans and has come up to Maine to escape the Louisiana heat, and we're delighted to have him with us today. A warm welcome to James Farwell.
Thank you very much indeed for inviting me to come here. This is such a fabulous group with a wonderful program. And I have to give one disclaimer with that gracious introduction, which is that while I do and have advised various parts of the Pentagon, I'm speaking only for myself, and none of my opinions in any way express those of the United States government or any of its departments, agencies, or any of its combat commands, which you get is just purely what I think about things. My interest in writing this book, and part of my interest, is that I'm interested in how people use, political players use, communication to compete for power, to consolidate their grip on power, to undercut other opponents. And that is the dimension through which the Pakistan Cauldron is written. As it happens, the official business in Pakistan is really conducted in English. Benazir Bhutto, who was a central figure in the book, did not speak Sindh. She was educated in a Catholic school. Then she went off to Harvard. Then she went to Oxford and eventually came back. You have to be able to read, I'm not fluent in it, but you get translators, to be able to read Dari and Pashto in some of the social media. But the official business of the country is done in English, which was great for me because in order to look at the social dynamics of a country, one of the things to remember, and this applies to our own presidential election, what politicians say or do in public is far more important than what they say or do in private. All of you have been following the presidential election here in this country, and all of you will have informed views of where Romney stands or Obama stands and who might win. You haven't necessarily been in Iowa or Florida or any of these other states, but you're able to follow the discourse, and that's what's really important if what you're interested in is understanding the political dynamics. I used to get an email from Karl Rove if I was in a campaign, and they were very, very short. Who's ahead? Who's behind? How's it moving? Where's the momentum? What's likely to change it? And politics exists really at that level. Pakistan, obviously, like every country, has many differences. And that also, I thought, was very interesting because in looking at how people use communication, I was, of course, attracted ultimately to what was the impact of the bin Laden attack in terms of this culture, and what did it reveal, and how did they get there? And what you see is that the reaction in Pakistan, whose after effects are still being felt today, is very much a reflection of five decades of dysfunctional politics in a fascinating country filled with very talented, energetic people that is characterized by a sense of conspiracy, a feeling of betrayal, a sense that their fate and what goes on in their country is determined by factors that are external to them. It is a classic case of a nation that has a very weak national identity. People identify with families and with tribes in Pakistan and not so much with the country. But that has a very profound impact on the dynamics. My friend Marvin Weinbaum of the Middle East Institute, who was my chief reader, was in Pakistan not long ago, and he went to a dinner party, and some minister was going to go to Kazakhstan or something like that. They spent 3 hours devising the most arcane conspiracy theory for why this guy was going to Kazakhstan. And then at the end of the dinner party, somebody came in and said, news bulletin, the trip's been canceled. And they were going to have lunch the next day. Marvin said it was the most amazing thing he'd ever seen. By the time he got to lunch, they had had a completely new and better set of theories as to why the trip was done. I mean, the guy was going to discuss, like, farm supports or something like that. Benazir Bhutto summarized this ethic and politics as well as anybody. She said that in Pakistan, there is always the question behind the question. And I think that's something that is the aptly summarized part of the dynamic that that animates Pakistani politics. My book, and I'm not going to recount the details of it because I know that everybody here wants to have five copies, four for them to give away as presents. And I didn't do the jacket design, so I can brag about it. It looks great on a coffee table. So, although I think it's a very good read, but it looks great, and it'll give you a sense of gravitas. So I encourage you to buy as many as you can, and then to email everybody in your list and get all of your friends to do it. But it tells the story of Pakistani politics over the last 40 or 50 years, primarily through the eyes of two people. One is Benazir Bhutto, whom I thought was very remarkable as an individual, and the other is Pervez Musharraf, who was the president of Pakistan through most of the last decade. And it's just very interesting to look at their lives and how they saw things. Musharraf was a general who was very patriotic. He was a great admirer of Ataturk. He was a very courageous officer and obviously very adept at operating within the confines of the Pakistani military. The military in Pakistan occupies a privileged position. This is not unusual. You can see it in Egypt. The presidential elections in Egypt are likely to turn ultimately on what position the military will take vis-a-vis the new president. The military has its own business operations, its own perks, its own standing in society, and it's not as efficient as the Pakistani military, but it's the same sort of thing. It's true in Syria as well. In Pakistan, the military is probably one of the few institutions associated with government that actually works. I mean, everything works. They've got great medical care. It is a meritocracy. It is not a place that hires officers or promotes people based upon who you know. It's what you do, and they're very proud of that, and it's one of the great strengths of the country. Just as, for example, when they developed a nuclear program in a country that's totally dysfunctional, I can tell you one thing that is not dysfunctional about that country is their nuclear program or what they do to protect its secrecy or its security. They take that very seriously. And the contrast between the effectiveness and the efficiency with which they deal with that and the inefficiency, the dysfunctionality and the corruption of what we refer to as the elected civilian government is, I think, quite interesting and quite striking. In the first part of the book, I talk about what Musharraf did right, which was dealing with the nuclear scientist A.Q. Khan. In the second two sections of the book, talking about Benazir and her effort to return to power in 2007, what he did wrong. And and the thing that I think I would say is that you should not just look at this book as a study of Pakistani politics, because the book was written to provoke questions. What decisions did these guys make, and how does that apply to other situations? most of the way that Musharraf looked at these situations paralleled what Mubarak did in Egypt, Ben Ali did in Tunisia, what Saleh did in Yemen. And they may have had slightly different responses, but asking the questions gives you insight into the mindsets of being able to deal with and understand all of these countries that tend to affect our own interests in one way or another. Musharraf, in dealing with AQ Khan, had a very difficult problem. In this country, if you wanted to be a pop star, if you wanted to be lionized by everybody, you would become Michael Jackson, or you would become Cameron Diaz, or you'd become a movie star or a singer. Think about this. The equivalent of that in Pakistan was the guy who helped develop an atomic bomb for the country, and that was AQ Khan, who was very patriotic. It's very important when you read about this international criminal, which is how the Western press portrays AQ Khan, to remember that by his own lights, he was a Pakistani patriot who wanted to be able to help secure Pakistan from its enemies, notably India. And that's true for Musharraf as well. And so you can't judge people by our standards. You have to judge people by the standards of their own country and by the ideals that they considered important. And I think it's very important to look at foreign cultures from their point of view instead of asking why they don't understand us. And I think that gets you a long way towards understanding the dynamics of politics in a place like Pakistan and these other countries. So Pakistan has had a very checkered relationship with the United States. In the 50s, it had a very close relationship because Ayub Khan, who was the president, arguably its best president, had a good relationship with the American military. But ultimately, in the 1965 war between Pakistan and India, in the 1971 war between Pakistan and India, and in subsequent engagements since then, the United States has tended to side with India and not with Pakistan, as far as the Pakistanis are concerned. When the Soviets invaded in 1979, we gave them a lot of help. But up until that point, we had pressed them, once we discovered that they had a nuclear program, to give it up. When the Soviets left Afghanistan in 1989, we left and then put pressure again on Pakistan to give up its nuclear program. So my point is that when everybody says, are they a friend or an ally, I always remind people of what Winston Churchill said, which is that nations don't have friends, they have interests. And that's the way the Pakistanis view their relationship with the United States. It's a very transactional relationship. Khan had been one of the people responsible for the development of the nuclear program that Pakistan had. But the problem was that, especially after 2001, when Pakistan made a decision under Musharraf to align with the United States in countering violent extremism, unlike his predecessors, President Bush insisted that they give up the nuclear program. On top of which, in AQ Khan, you had a self-promoter who could not keep his mouth shut. So the problem that Musharraf had was, how do I contain this guy from blabbing to the press so that I can continue my relationships with the United States, so I can protect the security of a valuable program that is the crown jewel in our defense, because after all, we're frightened of India and we need to continue to develop that thing, but at the same time, do it in a way that doesn't destroy himself politically. And the first section of the book looks at how he did it, and he was really quite brilliant about the way he went about doing it. He put him under house detention, took away his passport. It has still been taken away, and he still today has to travel around with an escort of the military. But while doing that, praised him as being a great patriot. And so the first part of the book talks about how he managed to accomplish that, and it was a brilliantly conceived and executed plan. And I mean, it's really interesting to me because there's lots of evidence that after Khan was detained and everybody said, including in Washington, said, oh, this is great. Khan's been detained. That's the end of the nuclear trafficking. Then that would be the end of it. There's actually a substantial amount of evidence that the trafficking continued. And to whom and with what is very unclear. The nuclear program for Pakistan is anything but transparent, and what has gone on it is not that clear. Most people think that the security of its armament, which is the most vital interest that the United States has, I think, in Pakistan, is pretty good. It's been questioned by some people, but that seems to be the consensus view among the people that I know that I think would be in a position to. Benazir Bhutto is one of these rare women in history that I think illustrates the point that a single individual really can make a huge difference. She was irrepressible. She was a very brilliant woman, a very eloquent woman, who had, on the one hand, a strong interest in social justice, and on the other hand, was a haughty aristocrat. But she was one of these people that was full of life. People I knew who knew her when she was at Harvard and at Oxford just loved her. I mean, she was one of these people who could show up at Oxford, where she was the first Asian woman to be elected head of the Oxford Union, which is their debating society. And it is, and trust me, to be elected head of the Cambridge Union or the Oxford Union is a big deal. It used to be that you got an invitation to stand for Parliament if you were the head of either one of them. It is an extremely difficult thing to do, and it meant a lot to her to be the president of it, and she was. And one of the first things that she did, not being bashful at all, was to make a statement to the House and in the society on Nixon. She said, you know, the United States started off with a president who couldn't tell a lie, and now we have a president who can't tell the truth. And they were all cheering and stuff like that. But I mean, you know, the idea of a Pakistani coming into American politics and lecturing us on what we should do was perfectly okay. A Congress resolution today telling Pakistan what to do might not be greeted with the best press that you've ever seen in Pakistan. She had a great sense of humor. She sponsored another resolution, which was that this house would rather rock than roll, and was famous for going up to London with all of her friends to get peppermint ice cream. And she was just a very lively person. She comes back to Pakistan in the mid-70s. Her father, Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, is the president. And he is one of these people that is both brilliant and dangerous at the same time. He'd gone to UCLA. He was, by any standard, intellectually, a very brilliant guy with all the wrong ideas. Ayub Khan, who had been president, had really begun to build Pakistan's economy. Had it stayed on that track, one could make a cogent case that Pakistan economically would be competing with India. But Bhutto saw himself as a socialist. And so he nationalized industries and drove a lot of the capital out of the country, all in the interest of being a tribune of the people. And he was a disaster. And he, at the same time, though a mesmerizing orator and a very flashy dresser, he could have been on the cover of Vogue on any given Tuesday. He was at home at a United Nations conference as he would be in a Mao suit haranguing peasants, one of these very great public people. But he didn't understand that politics is about creating a political base and a political structure in a society that's patrilinear and tribal so that you had a base of political support to work with. As a result of which, he understood only one thing, which is that the key position of power in Pakistan then and today is to be the chief of staff of the army. It's why when you see Panetta or any of the people in this administration or the prior administration going to talk to Pakistan, they tend to pay lip service to the president or the prime minister, and they go talk to whoever the army chief of staff is. It's because that's where the power is. Well, he understood that, so he said, you know, I've really got to get myself somebody who is a yes man. And so he turned, of course, to the Inter Services Intelligence, which is Pakistan's CIA, which had no particular use for him since he was not particularly pro-military, to put it mildly. and said, who do you guys recommend? And so they gave him Zia al-Kuk Haq, and who was a weird sort of a guy that had one interest in life, which was Islam. Makes this guy the head of the army, thinking that nothing's going to happen. The guy will shut up. And, of course, the first thing that happens is that ISI says, you know, Mr. President, you are so popular and so fantastic. You should call another election so you can get a new term now. And, of course, people like Bhutto are always, and this is true of all politicians, you'll find this always true, they're always on the lookout for compliments, always. If you've got something good to tell a politician about how wonderful they are, trust me, they have plenty of time for you. Giving them the solution to world famine may not be of any interest to them. And Bhutto was very much like that. So the ISI writes this campaign memo talking about what a brilliant politician he is and all the great things that he's done, and he falls for it. And then they go and they rig part of an election that he was going to win anyway. He's sitting there at home with the American ambassador watching the returns come in. The first returns are not favorable. He's convinced that he's lost, wonders what's going to happen. As a political consultant, one of the great, delightful things that you got to do in elections, when the candidates call you early in the day asking how does the turnout look, is to say it's low in our areas. And that usually sends them over the horizon. And so that's what happened to Bhutto. But in the end, what happened was that the election was tainted, and then Zia used it as a excuse to stage a coup to throw him out of power and to declare a military, they never used the word dictatorship, but to put the military in charge of everything. Zia also understood that Bhutto would not go quietly into the night, and so he therefore concocted murder charges against Bhutto and put him on trial for murder. And it's at that time that Benazir shows back up in her late 20s in Pakistan to bear witness to this tragedy. And the thing that was also amazing is that her father did not understand until it was too late that this trial was a serious thing. I mean, he would, you know, sit in his cell, take phone calls from reporters who would say, gee, you know, what are you doing there with your time in the cell? He says, oh, it's no big problem. I'm reading Napoleon to find out how he kept his generals under control. And he would have a scotch with people at the end of the day. But in the end, in a rigged verdict, he was sentenced to hang, and Zia hanged him. And Zia thought that the thing that he regretted the most was not having hung Benazir with him. And one can understand that, because she certainly was no friend, and rightly so, of the military running a country. Instead, Benazir is sent to a very cruel imprisonment in a just a really terrible thing where they tried to convince her to commit suicide, and she doesn't, and she is saved by Ambassador Peter Galbraith, whose name may not be familiar to you. When the 2009 elections took place in Afghanistan, you may recall there was an ambassador connected with the United Nations who was the one that blew the whistle on Karzai's fraud. That was Peter. But at the time, he was working with the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and he caused this the government in Washington to intervene and got Benazir out of prison. And then Zia is killed in a mysterious plane crash in 1988, and suddenly the military realizes that they're going to have an election. I mean, the realities of politics around the world are that in most countries, Burma is the most recent example of that, tightly held dictatorship that decided it could not sustain itself as a military junta. The same thing was true in Pakistan. They realized that the public was not going to accept a military regime any longer, and they weren't doing a particularly good job of running the country anyway. So they called an election. Benazir comes home at the age of 36 and runs one of the most amazing people-to-people campaign imaginable. I mean, you would have millions of people literally turning out in the streets and for rallies. And just these, you look at films of these oceans of people. And because she is such a spellbinding speaker, which is part of that tradition in the East, she really catches the imagination of everybody. Well, of course, the ISI was not amused by this. The ISI's attitude towards elections is very simple. Elections are a good thing, democracy is a good thing, and counting the votes is a good thing, especially when it's done before Election Day. But unfortunately, they realized they were actually going to have to count these votes on Election Day. So then it turned out that Benazir, who had married Asif Ali Zardari and was now pregnant, was back. And so they decided to schedule the election for a period that they thought was right in the middle of her pregnancy. It shows you how ingenious she was, that she got wind of this and then changed the dates, her due dates, so that they thought that she was going to be due in November, so that's when they were going to have the election. She had the child in August, was ready to campaign, and she rocked. Very clever, very clever. And then, when she wins the election, she faces the problem that the military and the intelligence services are very unamused, and so Mirzabek is the chief of staff of the army, and a guy named Hamid Ghul, whom you can see in any James Bond movie. He's usually the villain and takes different guises, but was head of the intelligence services, did not want to let her take office. And luckily, we had a very able ambassador named Robert Oakley in Pakistan at the time, and Oakley went over and essentially negotiated the transfer of power. They agreed to let her become prime minister, provided she did not interfere with the military, stayed away from the nuclear program, and basically didn't cause any problems for their perks and their positions, which she agreed to do. And so she says, that's great, I'm prime minister. She goes to the prime minister's office. It is empty. It's ready for a realtor to come in and sell it to the next people. The military had stripped it bare. Plus, they intimidated all the people with experience into not serving in her cabinet. So she had to find completely new people. She's 36. I mean, what do you know about running a government at 36 when you haven't been in politics? Once again, she's very ingenious. She puts them all on a plane. They go to England to Downing Street, where they're given a crash course by the British on how to run a parliamentary government. And then comes back. And though she was not able to do a lot of the things that she wanted to do, she could not. She simply did not have the political clout to repeal some of the more oppressive rules that punished women. But she eradicated polio. She set up police stations for women. They were imperfect, but they were more than there were before. And she did, I think, her best for the 2 years that she was prime minister to elude assassination, which was an achievement, and to do what she could to change Pakistan. The military finally gets tired of this because she started asking questions about the nuclear program. So they, under the constitution of Pakistan, which changes every few years depending upon who has power, the president of Pakistan, who at that time was a figurehead, sometimes the person with power in Pakistan is the president, Musharraf, sometimes it's a prime minister, and there's no rhyme or rhythm. Right today it's divided, sort of like France is. But anyway, the president then dismisses her on some trumped-up charge, so now she's out. And her competitor, who is still the competitor to the government, is a fellow named Nawaz Sharif, who was something of a playboy. His brother was the chief minister in the Punjab, which is the largest province in Pakistan. And they sort of go back and forth for 8 years. And ultimately, Nawaz did not get along with Musharraf, who was chief of staff of the army. So he decides when Musharraf goes off on a foreign trip to Sri Lanka for some demonstration to deny the plane that he was on the right to land. And he very nearly crashed the plane. But Musharraf was very quick and very cool under pressure and got hold of some of his other generals who were friends, and they were able to forestall what was a civilian coup. And then he becomes president and described himself as the reluctant autocrat, the reluctant autocrat and the liberal autocrat. He liked both of those terms. And to me, the interesting, I found Musharraf in his own way just as interesting as Benazir, because I think that was really a very accurate description of Musharraf. The thing you have to do, and this is a lesson for looking at any of these countries in the Middle East or North Africa, or it's not so much true in South America anymore, But military people, generally speaking, do not make a successful transition to being politicians in running a democracy. I can only think of a few people in the last 100 years who were military people who were able to do it. Ataturk did it in Turkey. De Gaulle did it in France. Eisenhower did it in this country. I mean, people like John McCain have been successful in politics, but he has not been was not elected president. Most of the people who have tried, like Wesley Clark, who by all accounts of people I know who worked with him was an outstanding general, was a terrible politician. MacArthur was pomposity, got the better of him. I forget the name of the guy that Perot had as his running mate now in 92, he just slipped my mind. Stockman, yeah. I mean, he was a very capable general, but not somebody that you'd want in politics, and that's generally speaking true. And it's very important to understand that the qualities that you need, when people go to West Point, they get an engineering degree. They're very linear for the most part in their thinking, and politics is a floating crap game. And it's very unpredictable, and its dynamics are not hierarchical, they're horizontal. It's one of the reasons Colin Powell, I think, would not have been a successful president and ultimately would have been a poor candidate for president. He was used to people saluting him. And I can remember somebody going up to him one time and wanting to talk to him the way you would with a normal politician, and he took umbrage at the lack of respect this person was showing. Well, the answer was, General, get a different platform, because if you want to get into politics, you've got to be one-on-one with people, and that is true universally for the most part in most countries. And so Musharraf was a very capable soldier and very idealistic and very patriotic and good at military politics, but now he is in the realm of being a civilian president. And he was not an absolute dictator. At no point did he have absolute power. And one of the things he was very proud of, and one of the things that is so ironic about his being president, is that the press, for example, was much freer under Musharraf than it ever was under Nawaz Sharif. Sharif would send goons in to beat up newspaper editors and judges regularly. Musharraf didn't do that sort of thing. Eventually gets into trouble with the judiciary, but we'll get to that. But the point is that Musharraf said, you know, here I am, and I'm going to reform this country, and we're going to modernize it. After 9/11, he makes the decision to throw in his lot with President Bush, with whom he forges a very good personal bond, and on balance doesn't do a bad job. You could say that in terms of his economic stewardship, he relied too much on, as the government still does, on foreign borrowing, and they did not build a real infrastructure economically that could make a difference in the country. But on the other hand, when you compare him to the way some other people operated, it wasn't so bad. Musharraf's problem is the problem all politicians have who stick around too long, which is that they sort of go stale and they lose touch with the ground realities. And that's what happened to him. If you look at his poll ratings at the end of 2006, he takes power in 99, he, number one, has refused to have a referendum that is honest. He had one plebiscite, which was rigged, but refuses to have a referendum or a real election in which he puts himself before the voters that would have given him legitimacy. And so he never had that. And dictators crave legitimacy. And it's why you have these plebiscites in all of these countries. And if they only get 99% of the vote, they get very upset. But the purpose of doing that is that they want to have legitimacy. Well, he wasn't willing to do that. But still, by the end of 2006, if you looked at his poll ratings, he had like a 65% approval rating. Obama is at 47% right now and has been for the last year. At a comparable point in his presidency, Bush was about that. Clinton was a bit higher, but he wasn't in the 60s. Stellar poll ratings. In 2007, he's become very isolated, and he gets into an absolutely useless and avoidable brouhaha with Pakistan's judiciary and wants to set aside the Chief Justice Chaudhry, who is a political figure in his own right. And so now what you have is something that is also an interesting insight into Pakistan, and that is that you have 30,000 lawyers in dark suits leading all these marches Well, when you look at the news coverage of Pakistan, what you usually see are these tribesmen on the frontier. You think you're on the set of Gunga Din. That is not what Pakistan looks like. It is, in fact, it's got many poor people, but it has a middle class. It's very sophisticated in its cities. And so lots of this is driven by very well-educated cosmopolitan influentials. And Musharraf does not realize until too late that he's got a problem. Right at this point, Benazir, who's been hanging out in Dubai, is persuaded by the British that maybe she could come back. She goes to Washington and begins putting together a base of support in Washington, political support in Washington. And why does she do that? It's because aside from the military in Pakistan, traditionally, this is obviously less true today, but traditionally, the other base of power in Pakistani politics has been Washington. You might say, yeah, but what about the voters? To which the answer is, yeah, what about them? Not much input into what goes on in Pakistani politics. But she decides that she wants to come back, and this is a problem in many dimensions for Benazir. I mean, on the one hand, she had served as prime minister twice. There is a two-term limit. On the other hand, they're facing criminal charges for corruption. Now, it needs to be pointed out that nobody has ever proven that either she or her husband are guilty of any of these charges. When you read, there's some excellent books that have been written on Pakistan in the last year, and almost all of them refer to Zardari as having shown up as, quote, Mr. 10%, because he would take 10% of every deal, is the allegation. The fact is that Mr. 10% charge was stuck on him by ISI during the 1988 elections as part of a smear campaign against Benazir. Now, whether he's corrupt or not, I have no opinion on. That's an argument for another venue. But I'm just simply saying you've got to, in looking at these other countries, look at their cultures and judge them for the way that they actually work. Pakistan is no more corrupt than India is next door. And for those who wish to lecture struggling third world countries like Pakistan on the need for really good leadership and stewardship, maybe we can point them to the cradle of democracy in Athens. Maybe not. Or maybe we could point to statesmanship in Italy with Berlusconi. Well, maybe not. My only point being, be careful about judging people who don't speak English and don't have the same Western values that we do, because politicians are just human beings, and they're imperfect, and that was true for all of these. And that was true for Benazir. But she decided she wanted to come back, and that led to a series of very interesting negotiations between her and Musharraf. And the problem he had was he wanted to have a third term as president, and he also wanted to be president and chief of army staff at the same time, which the Constitution prohibited. And they go through this huge dance of who's going to get what, when, and where, and they eventually cut a deal that, in theory, is going to make her prime minister and let him be president. She, of course, intended to hold another election, that she didn't think that he could win. He, of course, was confident that she would never get two-thirds of the votes in Parliament to amend the Constitution, which would enable her to stand for a third term. Be that as, and then they passed something called the National Reconciliation Ordinance, sometimes referred to as the National Robbers Ordinance, which immunized most public officials from charges of corruption over a period of time, and that allowed Benazir and her husband to come back to Pakistan in order to campaign for public office without fear of being picked up. You notice that Musharraf, for the last year, had been announcing that on March 12th of this year, he was going to return to Pakistan and lead a new effort for the presidency. The last time I checked, he's still in London. And that's because if he shows up in Pakistan, he will be arrested and jailed. And he's decided that that's less entertaining than running around giving speeches at $50,000 a pop or whatever he gets. So you wind up with a deal being cut between these two. And one of the interesting things, again, is that Benazir is looking for ways to be able to transform Pakistan. And one of the things that's striking is that she's right on message with her strategic communication in Washington. But what is really important is this. Thomas Friedman had a great insight, which is that when you judge some Arab leaders, you don't want to look at what they say in English to Western audience. You want to see what they say in Arabic to their audiences. What Benazir said in Washington is what she said everywhere else. She was very consistent. And so she gets a lot of credit for having the courage to stand up for her principles. And indeed, I would argue that the thing that was most important about her and the great tragedy of her loss is that you had a powerful intellectual who was a powerful advocate and a very eloquent one for religious tolerance and for democratic pluralism. And those voices, especially in the Muslim world, are very hard to find. And finding one of international standing with that caliber is very difficult. But she decides to come back, and she talks about leading an orange revolution. And it's my belief that had she lived, that she would have, in fact, been forced to lead such a social upheaval. One never knows because history doesn't reveal its alternatives. But that was what she wanted to do. She felt that her first two times as prime minister had been flawed, and I think she wanted to vindicate herself. And Mark Siegel, who is an American, in Washington, a very capable, able counselor to her, is very insistent that she was absolutely dead serious about doing these things, and he was as close a counselor to her as she had, and I don't have any reason to doubt that. The problem with Benazir coming home, of course, is that all these intelligence people who had murdered her father, imprisoned her, conducted arguably assassination attempts against her, and who are now watching this woman giving speeches saying, you know, I think we ought to have hearings and bring transparency to the nuclear program, maybe have relations with Israel. We're going to crack down on the truck mafias. We're really, she never talked about the Pakistani Taliban, but she did talk about organizing a cohesive war against the Afghanistan Taliban and against Al-Qaeda, and that's important, as you'll see, is now coming back. And so she is viewed by them as an existential threat. And she comes back, and when she does, emerges one of the real controversies over her return. She wanted Blackwater, which was a security firm, to provide security. And for reasons that are very unclear to me, and I could never get a straight answer from Musharraf's people. And Musharraf was the only major person I could not get an interview with. He wouldn't talk to me. But some of his people did. Was why he wouldn't let her do it. Musharraf committed capital stupidity in the way that he handled her return. It was clear that she was being tracked by assassination squads from the time that she arrived in Karachi. There was a major attempt on her life on the day that she arrived. But if you had been in his position, what you wanted to do was to go out of your way to give her as much protection as you can and then to communicate to everybody that you've done that. And he didn't understand any of this. And in one section of the book, which I sort of think of as a dictator's playbook, I try to get inside his mindset of how did he view her assassination and how did he try and do damage control. And I do it through a set of very caustic rules, such as, you know, for example, you know, if the target has been hit by a bullet and killed by a bullet, and that's not your story, it's a good idea to get to the attending surgeon before he holds the press conference, or else it can be very awkward. And that sort of thing went on and on and on. And so Musharraf, on the one hand, is totally shocked when she's killed, and on the other hand, really doesn't. Not only does he not know what to do about it, but totally mishandles all of it. And the result of it is he shreds his own credibility. He never seemed to grasp that her death would also be terminal to his own political prospects, but it was. And I'm not going into all the details in the book, but what I do is show how they used communication to position themselves in dealing with all the problems that they had. I mean, to me, it's if you talk to the Benazir people, they think that Musharraf is totally responsible for this happening, and I think that he certainly could and should have done a whole lot more to protect her. On the other hand, all you have to do is look at footage of her addressing the sea of people, and you would never allow a president of the United States to do that. I mean, the security implications are just absolutely impossible. The other thing about a lot of the politicians in the East is they're very fatalistic. There is this sense that, you know, it can't happen to me. One of the Newsweek reporters was with, how does he pronounce his name, Mujibur Rahman, who was the founding leader of Bangladesh. And he said at one point, you know, aren't you worried about the fact that you're going out in the middle of all these people and a lot of turmoil without any security? He said, ah, you don't understand, Tony. My people, they love me. He was shot a month later. Indira Gandhi had been told for 6 months to get rid of her Sikh bodyguards. She said, you don't understand. I mean, these are my people. They adore me. Well, maybe so, but they still shot her. And Benazir had that same kind of fatalism. And my book discusses this and shows how she dealt with it and some of the questions that have been raised. In the final section of the book, I use that to evaluate what is going on in Pakistan and to see where things are with Washington and Pakistan. And, of course, it's thrown into high relief by problems emanating from the war in Afghanistan. The thing to understand about Pakistan, and I'm sure you've read about this, is they have this innate paranoid fear of India, which, frankly, could care less about Pakistan as long as they would stop allowing terrorist groups to go into India and commit terrorist acts. India is not about to start a war with Pakistan. But Pakistan, its army uses the threat of India as a bugaboo to justify its budget and its position, and indeed the paranoia really does exist. And so when you deal with things like Afghanistan, which they see the Karzai government as part and parcel or an ally of the Indians, and so they see themselves being encircled by India in the east and then in throughout Afghanistan in the west. And so much of the tension that you see coming with the United States emanates from this sense that the U.S. is not doing enough to try and rein in India, that it's pro-India. The nuclear deal that was announced with India sent them up the wall. And it's more complicated than that, and I can talk about that if you want to, but you just need to understand that that's what's going on. And then finally, we have, in last year was very tumultuous. You have assassinations of major ministers who stood for tolerance. A guy named Raymond Davis, who worked for the CIA, is picked up, and he has a Glock. He has photographs of frontier installations. And to put it mildly, it blows the cover off of a simmering controversy as to whether or not the U.S. has too many people operating in Pakistan that they don't know about, which the Pakistanis don't like. And the analogy would be assume that another country had all of its agents operating in Washington without our knowing about it. Would we be upset about it? Of course, the answer is that we would be. And that's really been their problem. The bin Laden raid really put this thing into high relief because it put the Pakistanis into the position of if they did know that bin Laden was in Abbottabad, then they were complicit. And if they did not know, then they were incompetent, neither of which made them look good. It made the military look bad and caused questioning in Parliament about the competency of the military, which therefore is a question about whether you should give them the money that they want. That was one set of questions. There were questions as to whether or not the United States has been too arrogant. Again, remember earlier I talked about the times in the past that from a Pakistani point of view, the U.S. has not been there to support Pakistan. Now, I'm not editorializing about that. I'm merely making the point that the way they see it is that when the chips are down, we'll always be with India, now with Pakistan. And so they resent all of this, and they're terrified that we're going to swoop in one day and seize their nuclear armory. And I simply cannot overstate to you the sense of paranoia that crops up in the conspiracy theories in each of these incidents. When one minister was assassinated, if you look at the stream of press coverage and talk shows, there are, imagine a country with 50 Fox News TV stations. Welcome to Pakistan. And anything goes. And it's amazing. I mean, you know, somebody's shot before your eyes and they say, well, I guess he's dead and this is just a real murder. Oh, we don't know that. We've just got to look and make sure that this is it. You know, that's just the nature of things. But what you wind up with is a country that is likely to muddle through, that is threatened with economic collapse and held afloat by the foreign loans, really, that we give them, not the foreign aid. A country that now faces an insurrection by Islamic extremists, which they didn't used to have before. The violence that these extremists heap upon Pakistan is violence that they blame the United States for, because their view is that if the U.S. hadn't been in Afghanistan, none of this would happen in Pakistan, so it's totally our fault. And it goes on from there. And what will happen to Pakistan is just very unclear to me. The loss of Bhutto deprived them of their only really able leaders. Zardari is a very good backroom operator, and he is an absolutely appallingly bad public retail politician. And he doesn't have that much power anyway. They devolved a lot of it to the prime minister, Jilani. Not that that necessarily matters, but that's because the military continues to hold the power. And when you look at my book, my hope is that you will find yourself asking lots of interesting questions about how these people approach problems. How do they think about them? What do they see as challenges? What do they see as the key things that they have to look at before they make a decision? When you read the newspapers and you look at the latest headline of Pakistanis being angry at Washington or Secretary Panetta being unhappy with the failure of the Pakistani government to go after the militants in the northwestern part of the country. It's in order to understand the answers to that, you have to understand the dynamics of the country. And so what the book is about is using communication so that you can understand the political dynamics of a fascinating, interesting place. I think I've probably wound up with a higher opinion of Pakistan than a lot of Pakistanis have about it. It is, I emphasize, a very interesting, energetic country with amazingly capable people. And I think it's rather sad that it hasn't done better than it has. It hasn't lived up to its potential, and one hopes that it will. So with that, thank you very much, and be happy to answer any questions.
James, thanks. That was fascinating, and indeed we've got a lot of questions. So I'll start off with the first one, which is, can the U.S. relationship with Pakistan be salvaged? And in your opinion, what is an effective U.S. strategy for dealing with Pakistan and making sure it doesn't become a failed state?
Wow. Well, the good news is I've Marvin Weinbaum and I have co-authored an article that will be published this Friday, which I will send to you, which addresses this in detail. The answer to that is, when you say, can the relationship be salvaged, I don't know what that means, apart from associating with the advancement of particular U.S. interests in particular areas. These broad statements, I think, are not useful. We have, in my view, two vital interests in dealing with Pakistan, and whether they are our friends is not one of them. The first is making sure that their nuclear armory does not fall into the hands of violent extremists. That would be a disaster. The second is that it is, as a practical matter, much more difficult to draw matters to a close in Afghanistan without Pakistan's help. I was just talking about Pakistan's fears of the Karzai government, whose constituency are the Tajiks and the Uzbeks and the Hazara, which was the Northern Alliance. But the thing to understand about politics is that it's very contradictory. People are on both sides of an issue. On the one hand, Pakistan does not like the Karzai government because they think it's too close to India. On the other hand, though they don't talk about it, the military understands full well that if the Taliban seizes control in Kabul, that today's Taliban, unlike the one that was in charge in the mid-90s, will have expansionist ambitions in the region, and they will immediately move over into Pakistan and try and stir up Islamic extremists. It's not necessarily the Taliban, or Al-Qaeda has no standing at all in Pakistan, but there are Deobandi extremists in the Punjab who could be very destabilizing. And the bottom line is that Pakistan understands that it needs to have an end to the Afghan war, one that doesn't create chaos because it would destabilize themselves.
So the answer to the question is that if we stay focused on the two things that really matter to us, that it is possible, I think, to be able to work with them. The key ultimately to working with Pakistan over the longer term is through economic means. They want a free trade agreement with the United States. I mean, we have one, I think, with Peru and all kinds of other countries, and their attitude is, well, what's wrong with us? And there are ways that that could be worked out for the benefit of both nations. The thing that they really would want and have asked for years is an umbrella against an Indian attack. And that would be very difficult to do, although I suppose in concept at least, if you got India and Pakistan to agree that the U.S. would step in if either nation launched a unilateral preemptive war with the U.S. determining what that was, you could do it because it would be meaningless because neither one of them would ever start one. But on the other hand, psychologically, it might make a difference. The military aid that we give to Pakistan is largely a waste of our money. The civilian aid that we have given to Pakistan has been totally wasted. It has not been an efficient USAID program. Congress has rightly put a lot of controls to keep it from being pilfered. The problem is that we did it so publicly that it had the effect of creating a lot of negative hostility. We have to come to terms with the fact that the Pakistanis are not right now going to carry the war against the Haqqani network or other parts of what's known as the Pakistani Taliban right now. They don't see it in their political interest to do so, and they're not sure that they can do so. The posture that they have taken is that if you're a member of the Taliban or associated with them and you're in Afghanistan fighting, then we'll go ahead and we're more than happy to cooperate with fighting those guys. But if these people turn their guns on the Pakistani government, then that's different. So I'm not saying this rightly, so let me say it in a different way. They're giving a pass to the Pakistani Taliban that will not attack the civil state in Pakistan and not giving a pass to those who won't. And the Taliban is by no means a homogeneous organization. So again, how do you engage with them? The answer is you focus on the things that are important to us, which is finding an orderly way out of Afghanistan and making sure that the armory doesn't fall into the hands of violent extremists, and then you sort of deal with the other things as much as you can. You can't buy their support through foreign aid. So the answer is you can do it. It's not easy to do, but it can be done. And that's a very simplistic way of looking in Afghanistan. There's many, many, many more complications to it.
Okay. Because you mentioned it, we'll ask a question about, there are a couple of questions about Al-Qaeda in Pakistan. First of all, I'll give you an easy one first. Was the ISI aware of bin Laden's presence in Pakistan?
Clearly somebody knew that bin Laden was in Abbottabad. I don't think it was the ISI. I've always thought that there are three intelligence services in Pakistan. There's military intelligence, the ISI, and then there is a civilian one, which is their equivalent to MI5. And the person who is now retired, Ijaz Shah, I think was very much responsible for that. If you look at the evidence, though, Nadeem Taj, who became head of the ISI, had a key position in intelligence at the time that bin Laden went into Abbottabad. Hamid Ghul, who is still, I'm told, very much associated with the S section, which is a covert section of ISI, could very easily have been involved. Most likely Shah had a lot to do with it because he was also the superintendent, I think, of the military academy in Abbottabad. I think that the intelligence services did know that he was there. I don't think Kayani did. I don't think Musharraf did, even though some people have alleged that he did. It would have been a very, very limited number of people. Pakistan is just too leaky. If too many people would have known, they wouldn't have had it. Al-Qaeda has no future in Pakistan. You look at polling data, and 75% of the respondents say that they don't like America, and 76% of them don't like religious extremists. Al-Qaeda, remember, is viewed as a group of foreigners, not a group of Pakistanis. Musharraf, in cooperation with the ISI throughout the last decade, was more than happy to go track down members of Al-Qaeda and turn them over to the CIA. Where they had reservations was taking the war against fellow Pakistani citizens, And that line was the deal that they felt that they cut with Bush. We'll help you fight al-Qaeda. We'll help you fight people who are in Afghanistan, but not our own citizens in Pakistan.
Unfortunately, on that note, we're going to have to bring it to a close. I've got a whole bunch of questions that I haven't had time to ask you, but this is terrific, James. It's been a fascinating look at what has led us to where we are, what has led Pakistan to where it is. I really appreciate it.
Thank all of you very much.
It was terrific. Okay, unfortunately, we have a whole bunch of questions.
Sorry about that. Happy to spend more time.
Yeah.